evening, everybody. My name is Chris, and I am an alcoholic. It's really great to be at this meeting. It's a pretty new meeting. I don't know that I've been here before, but you can feel the enthusiasm in this particular group. That's very important. I got sober in the 80s, and I didn't know about going to enthusiastic groups. I thought that a group was a group was a group, a meeting was a meeting was a meeting. And, you know, some of those meetings I went to back in the day, I got to tell you, they just brutal. There'd be about seven old guys sitting around talking about what happened in their yard that day or something. And they'd be like, yeah, you know, I was pruning my rose bushes. And it would just go on and on and on. And I, you know, I was saying to myself, what does any of this have to do with staying sober? I got no clue. And, you know, I learned that I was right. You know, that sharing, you know, all this stuff has nothing to do with staying sober. It's just, you know, somewhere along the line, meetings got so off track that just anything could go. So when I see a meeting like this that really makes a point of bringing people up who have a message of depth and weight, I really like to support these meetings. And you know what? People come. You build something like this, and people show up, and it's just great to be playing a part in that. You know, there was a man who changed things. For the longest time, drunkologues were, you know, that's what you did. If you were asked to speak somewhere, you told your drunkologue. And listen, there's a time and a place for a drunkologue, and we, you know, if you're speaking, it's really a good idea to qualify. But, you know, it basically doesn't say, tell what it's like and what it was like and what it was like, and then, you know, thank everybody and sit down. You know, you're really supposed to share some experience, strength, and some hope. And a lot of that has to do with recovery, a message of depth and weight. And one of the men who changed the landscape back in the 70s was a man named Chuck Chamberlain out of L.A. in California. And this man changed the landscape. Instead of telling a drunkologue, he would get up and he would give a spiritual talk. He would give a spiritual talk. And listen, people ate it up because, you know, how many times do we need to hear, you know, what it's like to get drunk? I don't know about you guys, but a lot of people end up leaving AA because it just gets too damn boring. That's really what happens. And, you know, you find other places to be. So there needs to be some type of message of depth and weight, some type of recovery being talked about. And Chuck Chamberlain did this. You know, he would talk about God. He would talk about, you know, what the real problem with alcoholism is. Alcoholism is a separation from man and God. That's what alcoholism is. And we drink in response to the pain of that separation. And, you know, talking like this is the first time anybody really got down that deep into the causes and conditions of alcoholism. And you know, he changed the landscape. And I can get away with what I do, basically, because he paved the way. You know, I try to talk about alcoholism. What is it? How does it present, you know, and what the solution is? And tonight, what I'd like to do is I'll qualify a little bit, but what I want to talk about is I want to talk about immunity, and I want to talk about prevention, and in a way that you're probably not used to hearing. When you hear the word prevention, if you're from my generation, you think of Nancy Reagan. There was a big push that she had, you know, during the 70s and 80s, or during the 80s, or whenever Reagan was in. And it was basically, just say no. I mean, that's all you need to do is just say no. And that bypasses the whole nature of alcoholism or addiction or anything. It misses the whole point of what our problem is. What our problem is... we are powerless over alcohol. If we're an alcoholic, we are powerless over alcohol. What does that mean? I'll give you some examples from my own experience. Listen, I drank alcohol absolutely because of the pain of separation from man and God. There's no doubt in my mind today that that's what drove me to drink. I was uncomfortable with myself. I was uncomfortable with my environment. Living in Chris's head was just, you know, a real brutal and agonizing experience. And every once in a while, I needed a vacation. I needed to check out, you know. And if it was with barbiturates, fine. If it was with opiates, fine. But what I really was I was really an alcoholic. And what happened is by about the early 80s, I was drinking every single night. And by the late 80s, I was so chronically alcoholic that I would need to be detoxed because I would go into the DTs if I separated from alcohol. And listen, this, I'm going to tell you what a normal day looked like for me in the late 80s. I would come to wearing the clothes that I was in the night before. I would stagger into the bathroom and do my vomiting calisthenics, okay? I'd throw some water on my face. I'd go out to my $100 car and go to my terrible job. And the whole time I'm going, I'm swearing to God I'm not going to do this anymore because, you know, we really, folks, we don't have hangovers as alcoholics. What we really do, and honest to God, clinically, we have alcohol poisoning. We have put so much alcohol in our body that we have poisoned our whole system with ethyl alcohol. You know, and much more, and it could have killed us. I mean, we get right to the point where you know, we almost need to be hospitalized in the last stages of our drinking. So I would be dying. It wasn't a hangover. It was being poisoned. And I would be swearing to God that this has got to stop. This has got to stop. And if you would ask me like 9 in the morning after like an hour's worth of work, if you would put a lie detector on me and say, Chris, are you ever going to drink again? I would say, absolutely not. Today is the day that I give this up for good and for all. And I meant it so much that the lie detector would say he's telling the truth. The polygraph thing would say, because I meant it. I did not want to feel that bad. But about halfway through the day, it'd be like 3 o'clock, 4:30, it'd be heading my way. And, you know, I'd get half a sandwich down. I'd rehydrate with like a half a gallon of liquid. I'd start to feel a little bit human. And I'd start to think, you know that decision you made this morning about giving up alcohol completely and entirely? You know, that's an overreaction. You know, I think we're going to need to modify that. That's really extreme. As a matter of fact, we might need to modify it on the way home from work and stop at the liquor store and buy some vodka or bourbon. That's what I would drink. And I would stop on the way home from work. Now, I swore to God in the morning that I was giving it up for good. And I was drunk by 5:30 that night, every single night for years. What is that? We love, our ego loves to say we have a part in that we have a responsibility in that. But if we're powerless over alcohol, what happens is that strange mental blank spot, that subtle form of insanity that precedes the first drink, we are not even there when we drive to the liquor store. We're powerless. If you can just decide not to drink and really make that count and give it up for good and for all, you know, entirely, on your own, without spiritual help, you're not what the book Alcoholics Anonymous describes as an alcoholic. The book Alcoholics Anonymous describes the person who can't quit. So when you hear things like, just say no, you know, that misses the whole point. One of the great things about Bill and Bob, I love their haircuts, don't you? I mean, you know, those haircuts are coming back, by the way. What I love about these two guys is they recognize the fact that you don't fight alcoholism with sobriety. They tried that 100 times. How many times have we all gotten sober? You know, and it didn't work out for very long. They recognize that you don't fight alcoholism with sobriety. Yes, sobriety is kind of important, you know, to get started. But you fight it with spiritual living. You fight alcoholism with spirituality. The 12 steps are basically spirituality for dummies. That's really what the 12 steps are. And what they do is they bring about a shift in consciousness. They bring about a spiritual awakening. And they bring about the direct interventionary power of a power greater than yourself that will prevent you from drinking. There's a couple of things that the big book talks about. Thank you. There's a couple of things that the big book talks about. One of them is it says that no human power will be able to relieve you of your alcoholism. Now, there's a lot of human powers that are going to try. Your sponsor, your home group, treatment centers. These are all human powers. They're not going to relieve you of your alcoholism. They'll help you in many, many different ways. A lot of times what they'll do is they'll make you ready for the spiritual process. But if you're an alcoholic, you are beyond human aid. And some of the things that it talks about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous is your ability to quit on a non-spiritual basis will depend directly on how much power of choice you've lost in drink. And really what our problem is we've lost the power of choice, we've lost our ability to think rationally where alcohol is concerned, and we are at the mercy of alcohol. Now, when you look at step two, it basically says restore to sanity. One time I did a little bit of study, and I researched the word insanity. And, you know, I thought insanity came from the psychiatric or the mental health area, because, you know, wouldn't you think that it would come from counseling or psychiatry? It's actually from the legal profession. In 16th century England, what was happening was people who were challenged, you know, mentally were doing crimes like stealing an apple off an apple cart, and they really didn't have the capacity to understand the difference between good and bad, right and wrong. They did not have the capacity. They were really challenged. And what would happen was in 16th century England or whatever, the punishment would be to chop off your hand if you're caught stealing or something. And the magistrates just got to a point where they just couldn't do this anymore. When someone would come up and they're obviously not capable of understanding that they did something wrong, they felt really horrible about, you know, putting a punishment like that on them. So they developed the insanity defense. That's where insanity came from. You know what the insanity defense is? The insanity, you get off on the insanity defense when you basically convince someone you didn't know right from wrong, you didn't know good from bad. You didn't have the capacity to understand that what you were doing was wrong. If you can prove that in a court of law, you can get off on the insanity defense. Now, think about the second step, restored to sanity. It's alluding to the fact that we are strangely insane where it concerns alcohol. We don't have the capacity to stay away from it in an unrecovered state. Has anybody in here relapsed? You know, I mean, anybody here really tried to, like, not drink and went to meetings and did, you know, made coffee and, you know, did all the stuff that you thought was supposed to work and you ended up drinking? You know, my question for you is meetings are not the treatment for alcoholism. Service is not the treatment for alcoholism. Those are both incredibly powerful things. But the treatment for alcoholism is the 12 steps. They learned early on that by doing these steps, you would achieve what was known as a recovered state. You would be a recovered alcoholic. Now, you're never a cured alcoholic because you rest on your spiritual laurels. You don't continue to practice these spiritual practices and exercises that you learn. What will happen is you'll expose yourself again to that insanity, and you'll end up drinking. But there's something in the book that it's talking, I think it's talking about Jim, the car salesman. I think that's what it is, where it says that after he went through the steps, after he accepted a few simple ideas that these AAs put in front of him, he's now in a place where he couldn't drink, you know, he couldn't drink if he could. In other words, he's saying that he can't drink. Even if he wanted to, he couldn't, because he's been placed in that place of neutrality, safe and protected, the 10th step promises. And that happens through doing these spiritual exercises. So, So prevention, you know, prevention of the next drink. I don't know about anybody else, but I really thought that what I needed to do was I needed to come into AA. I needed to, AA was like a big pep rally. Like, yay, yay, we don't drink today, you know. And we go into the football huddle where we're going to keep it simple. We're going to first things first. You know, see you back tomorrow at the loony noony break, you know. And you just reconvince each other not to drink every single night. And that's what I thought Alcoholics Anonymous was, a big pep rally. That's not what AA was designed for. Sometimes that's what AA has become, and I'm okay with the pep rally thing. You know, I think we can have some fun in the fellowship. We definitely can. But being powerless means you need access to a power greater than yourself that can work in you and through you and put you in a place of neutrality, safe and protected, preventing your next relapse. You don't have that power, but accessing a power greater than yourself can. Now, that brings me to step two. Listen, when I showed up here, I was not somebody that was really buying into the religious thing. I thought all God was all religious. And when I was just trying to get sober, Jim and Tammy Faye Baker were selling, you know, the non-existent heavenly condos and, you know, running away with the money. And Jimmy Swaggart is calling me a sinner on TV, but he's getting caught in the Texas motels with the hookers. And, you know, I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, I'm a drunk and I'm a reprobate, but, you know, I'm not a hypocrite. You know, I'm not out there like lying and taking money from, you know, retired gullible people. You know, I'm not that bad. So when I showed up around treatment and around AA, where they started to talk about God, I directly related that to this religious intolerance that I have. Now, in the book, it basically asks us to set aside any prejudice we have over spiritual matters, religious matters. We need to be able to set those prejudices aside, not get rid of them, but set them aside so that we can have an open mind. If we come to something with an understanding and we've already got this figured out, we're not going to be open to any new information. And because of the prejudice I had toward religious people, it took me quite a while to start to buy into the spiritual thing. So what I was doing was I was not drinking. I was going to 13 meetings a week. I was a treasurer over here. I was a secretary over there. I was, you know, I was working with a sponsor who didn't understand the steps. You know, I was driving the boobies from the hatch to the meeting. I was doing everything, just full blown, active. And through all that, I was able to stay sober about 7 months. But I was a cranky sober. If you haven't achieved recovery, you're going to have a very tenuous sobriety. And the difference between sobriety and recovery is like the difference between night and day. You can get sober by punching a cop. You'll 90 days, you'll be sober, you know, down at the county. But recovery is an accumulation of all the promises that you read in the big book. All of these promises are really what recovery is. And you know, to think that you got this thing when all you are is sober, that's what kills so many of us, because alcoholism is an incredibly aggressive illness. It tears us up. It's one of the only illnesses that kill people that don't even have it. You know, I mean, DUI crashes, and you know, I'll tell you what, addictive illness today is the number one health threat in the country. You take cancer and heart disease and put them on top of each other, and you aren't even getting close to the numbers that addictive illness is involving these days. And do you know how much money the government sets aside for addictive illness? About the same amount they set aside for syphilis. You know, nobody wants to give money because they're doing it to themselves. There's just such a misunderstanding. Look, if I'm powerless, if it's an illness, and the American Medical Association says it's a disease, which I don't personally say because there's controversy about that, but the American Medical Association does. If it's a disease and an illness and I'm powerless, You know, you would think that there would be enough help out there, the same type of help that there would be for cancer or heart disease. And trust me, there isn't. So anyway, step two, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. How did this happen for me? Pain is the touchstone of our spiritual progress. Being sober. I mean, here's what I was like sober. At 6 months, I'd go to a meeting, right? And you'd come up and you'd go, "Hey, Chris, how you doing?" "Great. Really good. Everything's fine. You know, fine, great." I mean, that was what my answer was. But the meeting would start, and I'd be sitting here like this. And listen, I was a judgmental good for nothing. I got to tell you, I could see hypocrisy 100 miles away. And I was, listen to this guy sharing. Oh my God, what a bunch of crap! Oh no! Oh no! What's his name? He's raising his hand. Oh my God. Oh no. Oh no. Don't call him. Don't call him. Oh my God. They're calling on him. Oh, now we're going to have to hear about his family. You know, tell somebody who cares, you idiot. You know, oh, he's talking about gratitude now. I think I'll go out in the parking lot and slash all four of his tires and see gratitude in action. You know, So, but I'm sitting here like this, and you ask me after the meeting, "How you doing?" "Fine, fine." I want to kill people. That's sobriety for me. Okay, that's what I'm like. So here's what happened. This guy, Radio Shack Mike, one of the guys that was stupid enough to hang out with me in this state, gave me a set of tapes one time. He would go to like the New Age bookstores, and he had recovery tapes and stuff. And he threw me a bunch of tapes one time. 8 90-minute tapes, Joe and Charlie workshop, and he said, "This is hardcore. I didn't really like this, but you know, you might like it." So you know, I listened to this thing, and here's what it said to me, and I couldn't get with it. I couldn't assimilate this because here's what it said: "Chris, you know, you've been going to the fellowship like you're the fellowship pope. But you have no program because you're not working the steps out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you're not working the steps out of the big book, you have no AA program. So when you come back or when you go out, don't tell people that AA didn't work because you weren't working it." Now, this is the message. Now, you got to understand, I'm going to meetings like a wild man. Nobody's talking about the big book. Every once in a while, there's a step meeting where you go and you share about the step and you read about the step and you talk about the step and you think about the step. You just don't do them. You know, you agree with them in theory. You know, "I agree with that in theory. You know, I haven't done this step formally, but I'm going to share on it, you know, and take the whole meeting hostage for 10 minutes, giving you my opinion on what I think it might be about." You know, and that's what was going on. So Joe and Charlie's message basically said that all the groups I was going to, everybody in all the groups I was going to, and my sponsor, didn't have a clue. Now, imagine being confronted with something like that. Either Joe and Charlie are right, or all the group members and my sponsor are right, and you just share to stay sober. Now, I put those tapes to the side out of resentment. You know, what do people in Arkansas know anyway? You know, these guys are from Arkansas, for God's sake. I do more thinking before 9 o'clock, you know, than somebody from Arkansas. So I put them to the side. But what happened was, if you're just staying sober, it basically says if we don't do enough of the spiritual work in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, it says we won't be able to get through the trials and low spots ahead. There's a warning. If you don't put enough spiritual work in, there's going to be trials and low spots that you're not going to be able to get through without, you know, relapsing and getting drunk again. So what happened was I was really, really close to a relapse. I had found Mrs. God's will for me, you know. She had like 7 months, you know, right out of the halfway house. You know what I mean? Like, I remember going to my sponsor, Phil, oh my God, you know, we really have a connection, you know. And he was like horrified. He's like, oh no, it's going to be an uninterrupted series of phone calls for months, you know, dealing with the wreckage of this travesty, you know. Oh, But and that's exactly what happened, you know. It was just god awful. But anyway, you know, that happened. Then I had one of the states I used to live in caught up with me. And I had to do all these amends and pay all these tickets. I basically fled to avoid prosecution, you know. Some people don't like it when you do that. I had to take care of all this stuff. You know, so I was losing my job. Everything was hitting me at once. And I was shattered. And I remember going over to my sponsor's house. And I never did this, just show up unannounced. And so I go over to his house. And I knock on the door. And he comes to the door. And I go, you know, I couldn't even talk. I was so emotionally destroyed. And he brings me in, you know. And he sits me down and he goes, Chris, do you pray? I'm like, you know, what does that have to do with anything? Are you kidding me? But what he was basically trying to do was he was trying to help me solve the real problem. The problem was my spiritual condition. It wasn't that she left me. It wasn't that I had to pay traffic fines. It wasn't that I was losing my job. Those aren't problems. Those are challenges and opportunities if you're in recovery. You know, but they were killing me. So I leave his house, and you know, I do start to pray that day. But I go back to these tapes because these tapes haunted me. You know, there's a great line in the Big Book. We may have disturbed you about your alcoholism. When they hit you with the first step stuff, they basically say we may have disturbed you about your alcoholism. You know, they're talking about it in the chapter Working with Others. Well, that's all to the good, the book says. You want to be disturbed. The last thing you need is somebody who speaks and just, you know, does a comedy routine and, you know that what you need to be challenged sometimes. We need to be challenged sometimes. We need to be held accountable sometimes. This is an aggressive illness that kills way more people than have it. You know, I'm the type of alcoholic who needs to be detoxed when I drink. That's only about 15% of alcoholics, but 95% of those people die. You know, I'm in a 5% bracket of people who've been able to stay sober. That's bad odds, folks. You know, so I do. I take this thing seriously. So anyway, you know, step two, restore to sanity. What I need is I need to have a shift in personality, a shift in consciousness, a shift in perception that will place me in a position of neutrality with drugs and alcohol. And what that means is I'm not going to have the obsession of the mind. I'm not going to have that strange mental blank spot, that subtle form of insanity that precedes a relapse. That's not going to happen to me anymore. And that's been my experience. And it's been the experience of everybody I know who's gone through these steps and then continued this process in their lives. So step three, I have the Joe and Charlie information. Okay, now I need to make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as we understand Him. You know, just what does that mean? Just what do we do? Well, step three is basically making a decision to develop a relationship with God and go through the rest of the steps. And I learned that from these Joe and Charlie tapes. So that's what I did. I took these tapes out. I hadn't listened to them in a while. I was still mad at Arkansasians, you know. But I took them out and I started playing them. I opened up the Big Book. I dusted it off. I had a Big Book from Treatment. Anybody have the Big Book from Treatment that people sign? You know, mine was like, Chris, you're the craziest son of a bitch I've ever seen in my life. You'll never make it. Love, Harry. You know, I still have it. So, you know, I blow the dust off of this thing, and, you know, I get a notebook and a pencil, and I start going through the tapes, and when they asked to do something, like we put this down in black and white or something, I would turn the tape off, and I would put it down in black and white, and to the best of my ability, I went through the steps. Where I was going to meetings, and when I was going to meetings, there was no one who would bring you over to their house and take you through the steps. That didn't exist. You know, in the 80s in my area. It was a meeting-based sobriety instead of a 12-step-based recovery. It was a meeting-based sobriety. And most of the alcoholics didn't survive those AA meetings. It was mainly cranky old guys who, you know, really, really weren't alcoholic. Anyway, not that I judge. So step three, I make the decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God by going through the 12 steps, and that's what I did. I did a real bad job with them. I didn't have any guidance. I tried my best, and what happened was, from you know, I did the four step and I did a fifth step. I remember going to my sponsor's house and he goes, what are all these columns? Where's your story? You know, he really thought that a four step was a life story. So I said, don't worry about it. Let me just read these. You know, this is what the big book says. So I read that. I did the fifth step. I went home for the hour. I did six and seven. I put together an amends list. I went out and I made amends. And I did this not out of a sense of virtue, not to be like the best AA guy out there. I did it because I was tired of feeling really bad emotionally and spiritually and mentally. I was just suffering so much in my own skin without being able to check out and go on an intoxicant vacation. So I went to, and now here's what started to happen. I didn't really see it. It was kind of, it talks in the spiritual appendix. It says that some of us have slower spiritual awakenings of the educational variety. It's basically because we take a long time to do the steps. Some of us have sudden and profound spiritual awakenings because we do the steps quickly. But, you know, I took my time with them, so I had the spiritual awakening as an educational process and experiential over the course of time. But what happened was I started to recover, and it showed, and, you know, a lot of people saw the changes in me. There were significant changes in a relatively short few months, and people were coming up and saying, would you sponsor me? You know, it was like every psychopath in the world was asking me, I think, at one point in time. And they were coming up, and most of them were drinking on me. You know, has anybody in here work with people and they drink on you, make you look bad? You know what I mean? You lose status, you know. Is Harry yours? You know, do you know he's drinking, he's hitting on the women, and borrowing money? Yeah, Harry's mine. I'll talk to him. You know, so this was happening. So I get the idea. I get the idea to bring them over my house and do what I did with the big book, because that's kind of what Joe and Charlie was saying to do. So I started bringing people. This is 1991. I start bringing people over to my house and I start taking them through the steps. Now here's the interesting piece of this. The interesting piece is every single person who went through the steps and did their fifth step, did their amends, developed a prayer and a meditation discipline, 10 and 11, and actually went out and worked with other people. Every single one of those guys is still sober from the early 90s. They're still good friends of mine. They're still going to AA. There were a lot of people who asked me for help, but when it came to some tough step work, they realized that they'd overreacted. You know what I mean? Like, wow, man, you know, all these columns. Yeah, you know, those guys are all gone. They're all gone. I'm not saying they're drinking. They're just gone. You know, they're somewhere else. The people who stayed were the people who went through these steps. And I believe that, I've learned this particular lesson myself. I stay real current with this stuff because of that lesson. It's my job to keep in fit spiritual condition. It's God's job to keep me safe and protected. You know, that's the best way for me to describe it. But so I participate in things like this when I'm asked to talk or whatever. I participate. But the spiritual awakening is basically the promises. It's that shift in perception. It's being placed in a position of neutrality. It's exactly what you really want and don't know it. One of the crazy things about alcoholism is what kills most of us is a lack of understanding of what the problem and what the solution is, and a lack of enthusiasm to understand what the problem and the solution is. A lot of times we don't want to know. You know what I mean? We don't want to know. Great story. I love this story. Little Bobby is about 7 years old. He gets a toothache. And he knows that if he goes to his mother will crush up some aspirin, give him some aspirin, the toothache will go away. He knows that, but he doesn't go to her. He's hoping that it'll go away himself. Why is he doing that? Because he knows, his mother will crush up the aspirin and get rid of the toothache so he can go to sleep. But tomorrow, a phone call will go out to Dr. Mengele, the dentist. And he'll be in the dentist chair the next morning with the blood and the suction and the drills and the smoke. And, you know, he'll walk out of there 2 hours later with perfect teeth. He doesn't want perfect teeth. He just wants the toothache to go away. And so often that's what we're like. We don't want spiritual help. We don't want a spiritual awakening. We just want to get out of the jackpot We just want the pain to stop. The problem is there's only perfect help. The perfect help of the spiritual awakening. That's what this fellowship, that's what this program is about. Step 11, I absolutely love step 11. You know, I'm finishing up a couple of books now. One of them is the Idiot's Guide to Meditation. I like to pretend sometimes I really know what I'm doing. You know, I read books like that, and it shows me that I've missed a lot, and there's a lot more that I could be doing. But I love step 11. I've found a great deal of comfort in the search for spiritual truth and spiritual practices. I've gotten involved with a lot of different people, you know, around the country or whatever, looking at different practices and applying some of this stuff in my own life. You know, what I found was when I was drinking, I knew that there was something really wrong with me, and I was buying a lot of self-help books. I had a library of self-help books. But what I would do is I'd read the self-help book, and it'd get to the point where we went out and bought a notebook and wrote down the 25 things that that's work. You know, what I was trying to do is I was trying to intellectually learn my way spiritual. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. It's all about action. If you're new in here and you've got a sponsor who's a real pain in the ass, they keep telling you to do this and do that, there's a real good reason for it. They don't care what your opinion is. You know what I mean? Nobody's going to care what you think about something. What we care about is your life. We care about your survivability of alcoholism. And what we're going to be doing as sponsors is we're going to be giving you spiritual exercises. We're going to be giving you homework. We're going to be telling you to go over here and do this. We're going to be telling you to go home and read that. We're going to be about the business of giving you the spiritual tools that hopefully will lead you into this path where you will have a spiritual awakening and you will get to a state of recovery. Where your life, in the 12 and 12, it says the 12th step is about the joy of living. And I've got to tell you, most of the work I do today has to do with the 12th step. It has to do with carrying the message. I'm constantly in contact with alcoholics who are asking for one thing or another. And that's the joy of my life. It really is. I really enjoy it because I always feel comforted after carrying the message to another alcoholic. I always feel spiritually satisfied after engaging in 12-step work. And that's why it's the 12th step. You know, if you're new, if you're just coming back, if you're in a treatment center and you're just learning how to roll, you know what I mean? Like, you know, I know what I need to tell them to get through this travesty so I can get the hell out of here and do what I want to do. If you're one of those guys, please listen. You know, alcoholism is progressive. Over any considerable period of time, it always gets worse. It never gets better. So as the years go by, you may be able to manage it in some dysfunctional way right now today. And you may be able to pick back up and have it last a while. But if you're really an alcoholic, and I'll even say if you're really a drug addict, what's going to happen is it's going to be progressive and it's going to chip away at your life. And little by little, it's going to chip pieces of your life away until your life is incredibly small. It has very few people in it and there's not a lot of hope and it's pretty miserable. You know, what I would say is if you're new, you're just coming back, you haven't gone through the steps, you are in way more trouble than you think you are. Grab hold of one of the enthusiastic people in this room and say, listen, you know, I need somebody who's willing to take me through the steps. Would you take me through the steps? And get this thing called recovery. I am overpaid today in every possible way, and it's all a direct result of the spiritual work that Bill and Bob laid out with the first 100. Thank you very much for having me.